Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special Conversations at Home chat with Chloe Sevigny. Hi, Chloe. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Stacey. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Thank you so much for joining us. And wow, what an incredible season you've had. The Girl from Plainville on Hulu. So wrenching. I can't wait to talk about it. And of course, season two of Russian Doll with your good pal, Natasha Lyonne. Wow. Two very different stories. Kind of like taxing brain-wise in ways that I can't even imagine. We will talk about both later on, but this is a career-spanning chat about your incredible acting career and also directing. You are someone who seems like you are never not working. Does it feel like that way to you too?
Feels like, yes. Since I started acting at 19, I feel like it's been pretty steady. You know, I've had those moments, you know, the panic moments, will I ever work again? Right. Every actor does. And I always find comfort in Frank Langella's essay, you know, The Demon Seesaw.
Oh, yes, right.
With, which, yes, I think really is satisfying as an actor. When you're having those moments of panic to read his essay, I find a lot of comfort in it over and over again.
Well, and it's funny, I talked to Zendaya about this once as well, who's, of course, you know, still at the very beginning of her incredible career. And even she, and I think she was maybe 21 at the time, said, I feel anxious when I'm not working. And right. I think any creative person, you fear the work because it's so taxing, but then you fear not having it. And, yeah. And it seems like that's what drives so much of probably your decisions and the incredible decisions you've made. What do you think most drives your decisions to whether to take a role, to throw yourself into something? Because now you do have choices, right?
Mm-hmm. I think from the very beginning, I've always just been attracted to talent and creative types. And, people with really distinct creative voices. So instead of like looking at actual roles, like I feel like I've been a part of a lot of projects where maybe it wasn't the most challenging role or a new type of role for me. I just knew overall it was a project I wanted to be involved in and invest my time in because I was interested in the artist telling the story.
Hmm. I love that. And actually, I do want to get more into that later because you have worked with some quite colorful characters over the last 20 years, to say the least. But I do want to talk a little bit about what you were like as a young person growing up in Connecticut. You've spoken, obviously, of your childhood and your exposure to New York. But before you started to get exposed to the artists in New York, what were you like as a kid living in the burbs? And how did you carve out a creative life for yourself, which isn't always easy in that environment?
My parents were very encouraging. From a very young age, my mom had this like wicker toy box full of hats and dresses and costumes. And she very much encouraged make-believe. And we lived on this charming little street that was very safe. And she would just open the door. Aww. And I would go outside. And I had this like little fort underneath a forsythia bush. It's very like, and I just like spent all day out there. Like, I loved being outdoors. I loved, you know, digging my hands in the dirt, picking crab apples, you know, making cakes. And
were you a dramatic kid, theatrical? And did you like to create scenarios for yourself? What was your...
More shy and quiet, actually. And then in kindergarten, my mother brought me to see Annie on Broadway.
Okay.
And that was a big turning point.
I think for a lot of young women growing up around the New York area, that was probably a turning point, right?
Yeah. And also I was really into Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, me too.
So seeing other girls my age, you know, acting really piqued my interest. You know, I was very into like wanting to live in a different time, in a different place, and like lying outside pretending like I was on the prairie. And
I can see that. There's actually a lot.
I was really committed.
I had the same. I had a half pint hat as well. Right. It's interesting you say that. There's a lot of anachronism in your work. There's a lot of period pieces. There's a lot of maybe a sort of resistance to modernity, I guess, for lack of a better term, which is really interesting. And to speak of Little House too, the female protagonism that we were able to see as kids in that series, and to see this young girl who obviously lived way before, you know, hundreds of years before, mm-hmm. I guess not hundreds, but well before our time, to see her owning her own stories and in ways that was so educational, I have a feeling that was probably impactful to you.
Probably, yeah. I think I was also very into like Wonder Woman. I had a Wonder Woman swimsuit that I wore. My mom would ask me like, how are you feeling today, Chloe? And I said, I feel powerful. And, like that was my go-to, which is like, wow, what an amazing thing for a little girl to, a way for her to express herself.
I love that. And yeah. What was your first performance? Did you do school plays or did you do community theater? What was the first
one? I did. Starting after kindergarten, like seeing Annie, I started a summer theater program at the Y in New Canaan, Connecticut. I think we had like Russian theater.
Ooh, that's aggressive for a young person.
I think like, yeah, one of my first performances, I was in Annie. Annie herself, but and then
who did you play in Annie?
Blur, maybe Molly, I'm not sure.
Okay, one of the other orphans.
Yeah, one of the orphans. And okay. We did Fiddler on the Roof, and I was like, yeah, one of the daughters or something. I can't even remember. It was so long ago.
But were you a musical kid? Like, did you enjoy singing?
I did. I loved singing. And there was a girl called Carrie Nix who was doing commercial work. And like modeling work.
Okay.
And somehow I knew she was doing that. And I was like, I want to do that too. I was very driven at a very young age, very odd.
Like in terms of wanting to do this as a career as opposed to just a hobby.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. And when you got to high school, did you have teachers or mentors sort of helping you curate these plans and telling you, oh, this is what you should do after graduation? What was your life goal at that point?
In high school, I kind of lost interest in a lot of things. I was pretty like modeling and got a little sidetracked.
It happens.
And my school was so small. I'd gone to school with like everybody in my class practically since kindergarten. And theater 308 was what it was called. It was a very specific crowd and they weren't my crowd. It wasn't really my scene. So yeah, I kind of fell in with a different group of kids that were, you know, outside the cafeteria smoking cigarettes.
Sure. Well, and those, you know, those kids, even though they do have maybe a tough time in high school, do often go on to do a lot of great stuff after they leave that.
No, to me, I felt like I found a lot more inspiration in them. They were into things that were like happening in the city and outside of Connecticut. And, you know, they introduced me to different kinds of cinema, Jim Jarmusch and, you know, Hal Ashby and like, so I fell in with this very rebellious kind of delinquent group and was not really into the instructor or teacher in the theater program. We didn't really get on. And then as a senior, actually, I auditioned. They were doing West Side Story and I had a shade. Aww. I auditioned to play a part of a boy.
Really? How did that go?
The cast was a little progressive for
I was about to say that's pretty edgy for early 90s.
Yeah, I was like 93. But wow. I worked in the costume department.
Interesting. Well, it's also, again, another theme in your work, androgyny, gender fluidity, sexual expression. It's very interesting that you were interested in that so young. And I do want to talk about how that informs some other roles. But I would love to just get started with, of course, your first role at 19, the movie that doesn't even need to be named anymore, but we will, Kids, 1995. Obviously, you and your castmates have spoken about this film for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. But I do want to ask, how do you think those collaborations with Larry and Harmony informed the way you saw yourself moving forward? Because for that to have been your first experience is a pretty incredible and somewhat aberrant first experience, right? You know, not every film is like that, that sort of guerrilla filmmaking style. But how do you think that laid the foundation for what you would do later?
Well, Harmony and I were close friends in high school, best friends. And
we knew each other in high school. I didn't realize that.
Okay. And he was at my high school graduation. Oh. He was in the city. He was going to NYU film school. And then we became romantically involved after.
Right. And you would make two other films together, at least two, right?
Yeah. And he, influenced me in so many ways. He was very opinionated and, we had a lot of friends who were in the arts and, you know, painters, musicians, different. And And we kind of were surrounding ourselves with this very indie-minded, indie-spirited kind of people and mentality. We were snobs.
I love the self-reflection as we get older, right?
And yeah, I think, I mean, it definitely informs a lot of my decisions for good and for bad. Mm-hmm. I think there were some opportunities back then that now I reflect on. You always say, oh, what happened? Could I have done this? Could I have done that? Would it have changed this? Would it have changed that?
And right.
There were some opportunities that I passed on, you know, due to, I don't want to say his influence, but, you know.
Sure. Well, you do have that voice, you know, kind of informing like, hey, that's not art. You know, that's too commercial. You want to stay true to this self. But then, you know, maybe as you get older, you learn to balance those two.
Right. And also, I think that Hollywood is so into pigeonholing that then, especially in that at that time.
Absolutely.
And being like an alternative girl was very different at that time. It was much harder to own.
Well, there wasn't a marketplace for that either.
Yeah, well, there was if you were like Johnny Depp, you know, like boy and rebel and embraced. And the girls was much harder. And so I think I got, you know, a bit pigeonholed as this indie actress. And there's, you know, there's not a lot of room for those or, you know.
Right.
So
I was trying to think, were there any women at the time to whom you could look as a model or like, oh, if I can have her career, you know, that's exactly the sort of tone and style of the work that I want to do.
I mean, Frances McDormand, there were like plenty of women that I really admired and respected and looked up to. Tilda, you know, sure. Leanne Moore, you know, I still do.
I mean, these are all people who are like thriving today, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Kirsten Dunst really navigated her career, you know, doing like the big commercial work and the indie stuff. And like, I really admire her choices and
yeah. Fantastic. Also starting very young, even younger than you did. And still just, I can't think of a movie she's made where I think, oh, that was a poor choice. She really has great taste.
Yeah.
And those early Sophia collaborations didn't hurt, right?
Or like Spider-Man, you know, also.
Yeah. No, that's smart. And actually Sam Raimi's Spider-Man is actually a beautifully made movie. It's super artistic. The performances are fantastic in that movie. Yeah. It's really fascinating and so impressive to see longevity like that. And I consider you in that camp as well. So after Kids came out and the world felt like it was ending because parents were like, oh my God, what have I just seen? It's interesting when I watch Euphoria now and I see the chatter, it feels so reminiscent of what people were saying. I can't believe kids do this. They do drugs. They have sex. It's like, this is not new. what kind of roles were you being offered after Kids? And did you have to push back on, like you've said, them seeing you as this sort of indie, you know, rebel chick that maybe you thought, hey, I have other stories to tell.
I did, but I also kind of embraced it at the same time.
Okay.
I wouldn't say the offers were really pouring in. You know, there was like some casting people that really believed in me in New York, you know, that were, doing other indie things here. So it was more indie fare.
Okay.
Yeah.
And obviously being in New York at the time, you really do feel very separated from Hollywood. And even still to this day, many people, you choose to live there because of perhaps the distance from here.
There was a lot of auditioning then, you know, pre 9/11, post 9/11, things really changed.
Right.
You have to go to LA, like to go.
That's a good point. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But there were a lot of auditions. There were a lot of meetings to be had. There were a lot of casting offices, you know, even like William Morris had an office here and obviously Miramax and.
Right. It was interesting. I did an oral history of the film To Die For a couple of years ago, and I spoke to the incredible casting team on that film, and she shared all of her Polaroids with me. And it was as if every young actor who was working at the time auditioned for this film. And it made me realize like, wow, casting really was this feeder system into careers that people, I think, just don't have that same support now that it's, even if you don't get cast in one thing, they think of you for the next thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what was so impactful for you is that you did make a lot of friends and support staff essentially in New York who were rooting for you.
Right. And I remember there was a lot of like generals. You go on like general meeting with a casting person and go in and have to charm them. And I'm always very intimidated by those situations.
That is really interesting. Things have changed so much. Oh my God. So the next film I'd love to talk about is Last Days of Disco, one of my favorites, Witt Stillman. My gosh. the brain on this guy. I rewatched it over the weekend and I was reminded that I still can't believe movies like this got made at all because it's so heady and so smart. But also what struck me too is the themes of this film. Obviously it takes place in 80, but it came out in 98, but it's riffing on so many themes that are still so present today. Gentrification, who gets to live in New York, whose parents are paying their way, who gets the jobs. Tell me what attracted you to him, because this was very different from what you had just done in terms of that sort of that kid's aesthetic. This was actually a, you know, kind of maybe a 180.
Right. Well, I know that there was like a competing Studio 54 project happening at the same time. And I believe my agent said, oh, there's, you know, this film being cast, and I watched Metropolitan, and that was, I was like, I have to be in one of this guy's movies. I hadn't even seen Barcelona, but I was just so, his voice was so singular.
So singular.
And the dialogue was so funny. And I also came from Darien, Connecticut. So I felt like I knew this type of person.
Sure. I feel like we all went to school with at least a few of these kids, right?
Yeah. And so I remember, I like auditioning, and I think I like lied and said I went to prep school or something. I high up this kind of like WASPy lineage. He was like just recently at my wedding, but Stillman.
Oh, how funny. Now, did he know of your work in kids? Did he obviously probably had heard of you?
He must have. I think he had done a lot of research. Yeah.
Okay.
And I had done Tree Lounge with Steve Buscemi. And I think he had poked around. He's pretty thorough.
He seems fastidious at the least, right? And tell me about working with Kate Beckinsale, because of course she would reunite on Love and Friendship in 2016 with Whit Stillman again. What was it like? She, you know, each of you at the precipice of both these huge careers, and this was her first, I think, non-British role. So she had to affect that great American accent, which she pulled off flawlessly. Mm-hmm. What was your rapport like with her? And did that start a friendship that has continued? And have you been able to stay in touch?
I have, yeah. I remember she was staying uptown, and yeah, I think she was having like a little bit of a hard go. It was like a long shoot and she was far from home. And I just remember her always reading. She was like, you know, always had her nose in a book, and I was very charmed by her. And Whit would often ask me to give her line readings to help with the accent. And I was like, I heard you're not supposed to do that. Like, I would have like panic attacks because I really like respected her and didn't want to.
You didn't want her to think that you were this like the American actress who's trying to like.
Of course not. We would crack each other up, and there were so many instances where we got the giggles, and he would yell at us, and like, what's with the giggling? And like, we had a really nice rapport on that movie. Yeah, but then she moved out west, and I didn't see her for years, and then we reunited on Love and Friendship.
But what a nice, what a trajectory too that you've shared and, you know, stay in touch, which is really touching. What did you learn from him about managing large amounts of dialogue? Because I feel like he was in some essence a precursor to Aaron Sorkin and how Aaron tests his actors and really forces people how to learn to act within this heavy, heavy discourse. What did you learn from Whit on that front?
I mean, Whit was very precise, you know, and there was a lot of repetition.
And probably no improv, I'm guessing.
No improv. Every and or but had to be exact, and certain words had to be pronounced certain ways, so for certain emphasis. So I think I learned a certain amount of patience, honestly. Because I don't think that I was like, I think I had heard stories of like Polanski, you know, with Mia Farrow and like things like that, but it wasn't like as much in the general consciousness about like directors, you know, behaviors. Mm-hmm. So I think it was pretty surprising to me, but I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to like, I have to embrace this as like an exercise and a way to learn to, you know, learn and grow and stretch myself and collaborate in a way that doesn't feel collaborative.
But also so, trusting the filmmaker that he knows what he wants to do.
It was challenging. It was learning a new way of filmmaking. Yeah. Every filmmaker, you learn a new way of filmmaking.
So I mean, being flexible has to be the most important trait in a performer.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. And of course, next we go to Boys Don't Cry, or as I've just called the movie, 1999, Kim Pierce, who I know who lives down the street from me, love her so much. Is it true that she had seen you in disco and that's what attracted her to want to speak to you for this film?
I don't know. I remember I went and auditioned for the part of Tina, Brandon Tina.
Right, right.
And she's like, have you ever wanted to be a boy? And I was like, no, I'm kind of, you know, a girly girl. She's like, why don't you come back and read for Lana?
Okay.
So, yeah.
And how much, if at all, did you know about the story, about Brandon's story at that point?
I knew a lot, actually, because Drew Barrymore was developing her own version. And she about playing Lana in her version. And, and she was trying to court Harmony to possibly direct. So,
wow.
So I read some of like the big articles. I think there was a big like Playboy piece. And
right.
So maybe I'd seen the documentary. I was pretty familiar with the story. Yeah, okay. And very moved and taken by it, and knew it was an important story to tell. And I wanted to be a part of it no matter who told it.
Mm, I love that. I talked to Peter Sarsgaard a few years ago and asked him, because I know it's a tough shoot, you know, not a lot of money, you know, like shooting in Texas. And were you in Nebraska as well? Shooting in both locations?
Texas.
Okay. And also imagining trying to film this story in Texas and just like culturally how difficult it must have been to even just pull this off in a place that, you know, even now this would be a hard story to film in Texas, you know?
Yeah.
What do you remember about the shoot and how, I guess, the communities received what you were doing? Were people aware of what you were making at that point?
I don't think so. I think most of the crew came from New York. I don't remember a lot of pushback from the community. We're working with Christine Vachon, who I'd worked with, Brad Simpson, both who I love and cherish. And I just remember like the camaraderie with the cast. I remember the passion. I remember like the enthusiasm. I remember how like in love with Kim I was and Peter.
You had a good cast. My God, what a cast.
Yeah, Allison Folan to die for. Like, yeah.
So great.
It was very tight knit. And I don't think I've experienced that before. I think there was also like something about being that age and not having like any responsibilities at home and being able to like go on location and really lose yourself in something. And
right. What most struck you about Kimberly's approach to the material as a director? I know she co-wrote the script as well, but what was she like on set? Because it seemed like she was really pushing you guys to just explore as raw and kind of almost scary.
She often also wanted to like draw on personal experiences. So I remember her really like meddling in my personal
life. that sounds like her, yeah. But Peter described,
this is what they're talking about when people.
Right. And also to have it be a woman who's really pushing the envelope. And had you worked with a woman director at that point?
I think I worked with Mary Harron on American Psycho.
So you had already shot American Psycho before you shot Boys Don't Cry?
I was wondering
about the timeline.
I still have kind of reddish hair, yeah.
Okay, got it. Oh, that's right. You can track where you are in terms of the hair color, right? Mm-hmm. But Peter told me a story of Kim just screaming at him on set because he's such a sweet guy. And here he is playing this really one of the worst villains on screen of all time, I think.
Yeah.
And how scared he was to really show that ugliness. But conversely for you, you really got a chance to show such beauty and tenderness and love. How much of that felt like an extension of you, but also how much of that was a challenge for you to be so intimate in those scenes with Hillary?
It was funny when I was doing the scenes, I didn't feel like I was doing them with Hillary. I felt like I was doing them with Kim.
Really?
Wow.
That is really, boy, that's a testament to her influence.
That's how I got there. That was how I achieved that performance. Like I saw more of the spirit of Tina Brandon or Brandon in Kim. And her passion for the story. And it was very contagious and, yeah, and I just so wanted to do it for her, you know.
So amazing. And essentially, you were all vessels through which she was exercising a lot of passion for this. Yeah. And of course, you got an Oscar nomination, let's not forget. That must have been huge. How did that feel for not only this film, this kind of fringy movie, and of course, Hillary would go on to win, But for you to get this acknowledgement from the Academy for a very, what seemingly kind of dangerous film to be sharing with the world, how did that feel on that morning when you got that call?
I remember I was in Berlin at the film festival with American Psycho. And,
oh, right.
I think there had been some lead up, like there's that whole campaigning and like the, you know, different awards lead up. So there was like a little murmur. But yeah, I was very surprised. I also like prided myself on being very anti-Hollywood.
So you were still in that mindset.
I was very much in that mindset. I was very much like last year, like, let's bomb the Academy and get rid of everybody. And like, start fresh.
Right. Know?
Real
right
anarchist style.
But then we realized we have to keep some of the framework and then hopefully help improve it, right?
Yeah. And then I thought like the women that I was like nominated alongside were like, you know, heroes of mine. Samantha Morton, Toni Collette, Catherine Keener, Angelina Jolie. And I was like, you know,
I mean, come on.
I'm operating in the system in the most subversive way. And I was like, right. This person, you know, is probably going to win and she should win. And right. And her voice is so important and what she's doing, like as an actress and outside of being an actress and just like, you know, her individuality and like how it she had like just infiltrated the mainstream with the most like kind of punk rock attitude.
Yeah.
All about her.
I love it. And did your career shift after the Oscar nomination? Did you see different kind of attention or increased attention?
So much.
Really? Okay.
There was a little more interest, but I was still like very New York based.
Okay.
My father had passed away.
I'm sorry to hear that.
1920. So my mother was in Connecticut. I never wanted to move west because I always wanted to remain close to her. Yeah. So I feel like there was like, yeah, probably not as many opportunities to infiltrate the mainstream.
Right. Well, you're prioritizing your personal life, which is also important. Right? Which is also hard to remember to do when you're busy. So I'm glad you had that time with your mom. So I wanted to revisit a film that I had seen years ago and I actually rewatched again, If These Walls Could Talk Too. And I rewatched it this week and Martha Coolidge, of course, directing. And for those who haven't seen, it's the sequel to the original film, but this time centering on three lesbian communities or three lesbian groups of women in different eras. And you, of course, played Amy in all of her butchness and her motorcycle and her pompadour in the 1972 segment alongside Michelle Williams and, of course, your friend Natasha Lyonne. And I also saw Rashida Jones in a crowd scene in there.
Lydia Wong.
It's like an amazing group of young women. Was this the project on which you first met Natasha or did you know her before this?
I had met her through a mutual friend before that, but yeah, that kind of helped cement our relationship. Yeah.
Okay.
I remember I had taken a loan from William Morris because I had to like help my mother with the mortgage on our house.
Really? Wow.
And they were like, you have to take this project to pay back.
So it was out of necessity, but
what the hell is she talking about?
But I love that though. I mean, that really shows the ebb and flow of, and also the choices you had made weren't necessarily the most lucrative films, right? If you're saying,
I was living check to check. Yeah.
Okay.
In the world. And, I remember going to LA to audition for this. And I think I met Ellen and she's like, you can't play Butch. And I was like, just you wait.
Ellen DeGeneres.
Lit a fire on me, you know? I was like, how dare she say that?
Well, it's funny because your character was way more Butch than hers, ultimately.
And of course, Stone Butch Blues and being like that was very influential and really informed my performance.
That's very interesting. And obviously, you played a lot of queer characters throughout your career. What attracts you to those types of characters and which parts of yourself are you able to share through those people that you don't get to share in your own life?
My own life. Oh, that's a big question. I don't know. I guess I've like always been attracted to people on the fringe.
Especially women who are just not giving a shit and just doing their thing, right?
Yeah. and women who, you know, yeah. Like Lana are interested in alternative things, but maybe don't even know it or do and are owning it. I don't know. I think that it's, you know, very multifaceted.
Yeah.
So yeah, each character is kind of, it would be different. Yeah. response.
But I do see you as someone who's operating outside the mainstream still. I mean, even though you have done more what would be called commercial work, you're still someone I think people see as she's the cool person who makes cool decisions. So you laid a great foundation for yourself. So you mentioned earlier that you had turned down some more commercially, what we'd say commercially viable parts. And I did read that you turned down a role in Legally Blonde. Is this true?
Yeah, I think it was the Selma Blair. Yeah.
Okay. Is that one of those instances where you think, gosh, you know, what could have been if I had done that part?
Yes, because you often hear of also like the being cast because you've been in movies that make a certain amount of money.
Right.
It was a big thing, you know, in the 90s and early aughts, you know, you kept hearing that, like, you know, if you've been in a successful movie, then you help with the financing, obviously.
Sure. So it's easier. Especially global financing too, when people think, oh, she's big in Europe. She plays well in Europe. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And when you, did you end up seeing the final, you know, version of Legally Blonde and think, huh, it's kind of hard for me to imagine you in that movie now. And Selma did such a great job.
Yeah.
But it's so strange how, you know, what could have been, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I love the movie now. It's yeah.
And it's funny too, because she made a lot of quirky decisions too in her career. She was always kind of trying to find her way. So it's funny to think the two of you may have been coexisting in similar states of mind at that point. So you also spoke of earlier working with artists who have clear visions, who also may be very non-traditional. Clearly, Lars von Trier, Vincent Gallo, Jim Jarmusch, somebody you admired before you started acting. When you're around these people and they have these visions that are maybe hard to understand on the page, how much do you just have to let yourself go alongside of prepping? Like, what is that balance of leaving that kind of cushion for just getting on set and letting them work their magic? And again, just trusting that they know what they're doing.
I mean, that's pretty easy for me because I really wanted to work with all of them. I was like a huge fan. You know, I remember like with Lars, Breaking the Waves was such an important film to me. And I remember
amazing
first getting on the set of Dogville, and we were doing these improv exercises, which were terrifying. And he was like grading us.
Oh, that sounds like every actor's worst nightmare.
Yeah, and I thought I'd gotten the worst grade, but then ended up I got the best grade in my like household, which is an awful tactic. Directly,
I feel like books can just be written about that production someday.
I was very willing at that time in my career to give myself over. Hmm. I think later in my career, I started to have a harder time with directors and all the sycophants around them. And I started staying the allowance that they got, you know, the creative allowance that they got and behaviors that were allowed.
Sure. And predominantly men you're speaking of, it, of course.
Yeah. I think that like, I was kind of voicing that pre me too, just as like, I'm just sick of all these dudes getting like,
sure,
praised and thinking they can do whatever the hell they want. And like, I think I was quoted as saying like, I hate directors.
There was something like that I heard. Yes. Well, what's hard is, at least from my perspective, when you're choosing to do sort of fringy work, artsy work, you're also working with people who are outside of the system. Thus, nobody's really watching them work. Nobody's as privy to their behaviors as Steven Spielberg or somebody who's working on a giant set in front of hundreds of people. So you have this kind of more cloistered.
Right, but there's still some of that.
Sure. Of course. Absolutely. And hopefully a little bit less now, but this is not a new thing. Yeah. This is not a new thing. And when you look back on some of those films and that required a lot of you, are you proud of the risk? And do you give yourself a moment to say, wow, that was really gutsy and brave of me? And then do you kind of fortify yourself a little bit knowing that I did that?
A little bit. I also think that like, I was like, oh, I'm not going to be embraced by Hollywood. So I'm just going to go.
Right.
Totally.
Right.
And really, you know, right, go subversive and right, choose to work on these projects that are really going to challenge the status quo and the norm. And I'm just going to be as like punk rock as possible.
Right. And really owning those choices.
Yeah.
Right. As opposed to feeling, oh, I'm taking these out of a deficit of not having other stuff. I'm actually choosing these, which I think is definitely something that you project as you've owned all of this. So none of this is happening to you, I think, it creates power, which is really cool. And then onto something very different, especially in the clothing department, Big Love with high neck dresses and and polygamy in Utah. I love the show so much. I think about Bill Paxton so often and what a just joyful presence he must have been to work with. I grew up with a lot of Mormons in Oregon. So the show, I think, did a really good job of humanizing parts of it, but also showing the destruction of a lot of this mindset and this religion. How hard was it for you to infuse humanity and patience into this thing, which I imagine, and I can't speak for you, you probably don't necessarily support the construct of this religion, but I can't speak for you. So tell me what you think about that.
Right. Well, when I initially read the script, I was like, I can't believe that this is happening in America and people don't know about it.
Like contemporary America.
Yeah. So I read Under the Banner of Heaven. I have a whole library. I think I still save this in storage of books about, women escaping polygamy. There were lots of autobiographies.
Scary.
And I was like, we have to kind of let people know this is happening.
Right.
And these women are like, they don't even know who the president is. They can't leave if they want. And young men as well,
Sure. Like
very upsetting. And I almost felt like we weren't talking about that enough on the show,
It was definitely, and I know the creators themselves came from the religion and they brought that at least sense of accuracy to it. But I was always struck by how kind the show was. Really. I mean, we saw the fringier characters, Henry Dean Stanton's characters, but really it was a very kind portrait of something that I personally find viscerally quite distasteful.
Right. I think they were also just like, wanting to challenge, people's idea of, what a family is, what it can be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure a lot of people, parents watching the show think it's actually not a bad idea to share responsibilities and really pool resources and energy and money. But I think the marriage piece of it certainly opens itself up for.
Yeah. I think consenting adults fine. Yeah. But the girls, growing up on a compound where it's forced upon them is where the problem really lies.
Right. The lack of choice and freedom. Yeah. And you did win the Golden Globe for your role in Big Love, which is very exciting. How did that recognition feel, even though I think it was a few years into the show, and obviously you're probably busy with other things. That must have felt like, oh, gosh, this is nice.
Yeah, really nice. It's always nice to be recognized. I was really proud of the work on that show. I felt like I grew like enormously as an actor, just like having the opportunity to do drama and comedy in one scene and just how rich that character was, the two worlds that she was juggling. Like, I felt so proud of that work. I still do. And felt like I learned so much. And from Bill, from Gene, from
others, an incredible cast.
Grace Zabrinsky, Bruce Dern.
Grace.
It's like epic character actors are just like who I'd always admired. And we had a great, kind of revolving door of directors coming in and out, who then went on to do like great work in television and have been.
And of course, Dustin Lance Black, who worked on the show now doing Under the Banner of Heaven. Again, somebody bringing a life of experience to that story. And it really does help when you have people with that lived experience telling the world, this is how it happens. Mm-hmm. I can tell you because I've lived it. And I think it means so much that the creators of Big Love, they understood the culture. And that's all we can ask, right? The authenticity piece of it. So that show for me kind of kickstarted just this incredible run of TV work. And then Bloodline in 2015, another of my favorites. Very different show, another very different show, playing Chelsea. And you have done so much interesting work in disparity of characters of economic class and status. I think about your character in Last Days of Disco, this very prim sort of upper middle class young woman. And you really also dig in really well to these working class characters. And I would love to know what attracted you to the Bloodline character, Chelsea specifically, who's kind of the moral voice. She sees all these terrible things going on. She has an allegiance to her brother, but she also acknowledges like she doesn't want any part of this violence, these lies.
Yeah, I think I'm often playing like the moral compass over and over.
You are. Yeah, I've noticed that.
Maybe I just project that as a person.
I like that. That's a good stereotype to have, though.
Yeah. I was very attracted to working with Ben Mendelsohn. And I knew most of my scenes would be alongside him. And huge fan of his, huge fan of the showrunners and writers and what they had done with Damages. And
that's right. The way they work is so unique.
Mm-hmm. And Kyle Chandler and, you know, Sissy Spacek, just the cast that they had compiled, like Norbert, who I went on to.
Yeah, I noticed that you worked on Plainville together. Yeah.
Plainville.
And did you guys actually shot in Florida? Did you feel like you had this really cool, very almost like you're at camp shooting so far away from everything? Were you able to carve out this kind of protected environment in which you could work and tell the story?
Yeah. And I think that also like the kind of acting that they wanted on the show was like very far from like, say, American Horror Story, you know, it was very quiet, very internal, more my sweet spot.
Right. Well, it's more drawing from like that theater. I mean, Norbert.
I felt like I was getting to allowed doing that series to go back to some like, you know, more quiet acting, which is the kind of acting that I really feel like I excel at. More internal. Yeah, so like doing that and just being in Florida in that setting, it's so easy to inhabit the character.
Oh, sure. Well, when you're that hot, right?
Swampy.
It's so swampy. And that's when you really appreciate that sense of place where there's no way to fudge that location, like on the Universal lot or trying to create that environment. It's you have to feel it. You could see just the drenched shirts. I feel like every scene, Kyle's shirt was just drenched in sweat. And it made me feel like I was there. Now, was that the first streaming series that you had done, like as a series regular? Because it seemed like it was kind of on the precipice of a lot of the streaming work that you would do, but I couldn't remember the exact timeline of that.
I can't remember either. Maybe, okay. Yeah.
Because I was wondering the difference that you felt creating a streaming show, which is essentially a very long movie that's then posting all at once, as opposed to them being unspooled week by week.
It felt similar to other, you know, you have like different, you know, alternative like DPs, and then
so you would have rotating directors in the same.
Okay. Yeah. So that felt very much the same. I was comfortable with that kind of transitioning.
I love that. And I love the thing that I watched, I watched Bloodline when it premiered, but it's so fun to see how people are just rediscovering things, you know, after they've watched everything else, they're like, okay, what else can I watch? And so now it's just this constant discovery of shows that are just sitting there waiting to be watched. It's very cool.
Yeah. A lot of people watching Bloodline. I mean, Big Love during the quarantine. I had so many texts and messages.
Really?
Like, wow. I never watched Big Love before.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, there's a definitely trapped feeling on the show. So maybe it lent itself to quarantine viewing, right? another role I'd love to talk about is the role of Sarah in We Are Who We Are. One of my favorite pieces of the last years, Luca, I can't imagine the joy of working with him. I spoke to him a couple of years ago about his use of nudity in the show. And he was so Italian and so just matter of fact about it. And he said something to the degree of, well, you know, sometimes in life we're just naked, we're nude. And I said, that is true, Luca. Sometimes we are nude, because I love this. There's such a nonchalance to it. Mm-hmm. And especially male nudity, which of course is still this thing where, you know, God forbid we would see, you know, lower male nudity. But you were very nude in the show. And I think you were pregnant when you shot this. I think that's, he told me that.
My first trimester. Yeah.
That must have been quite a thing being in Italy making the show. And did you feel sick during production?
I wasn't sick. I was just very tired and felt like very alone. And I also like didn't tell anybody because, you know, I was
of course
just not sure if, you know, the baby would stick, which is an awful term, but the term they use. So
the way it is, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I remember like having to go to this doctor, didn't speak English, and like bringing like the PA to come in to be my translator. It was like people that knew. And yeah, that was kind of, it was tricky. But just so much joy in Luca. I mean, what a joyful man. What a beautiful man. And talk about like, if you're like the arrogance of a director with him, like, I love it. Bring more.
He's just, I mean, and I'm not a performer or anything, but when you speak to him, you're just like, just tell me what to do. I want to do whatever you want me to do.
I love that. I just did another movie with him.
Saw that you have something else coming up. Yeah.
He was at my wedding too. It was a lot of drama.
Your wedding must have been the coolest ticket in town, by the way. I'm very jealous of it.
Yeah, she was there.
Oh my God, Chloe. You have the coolest friends. And again, on We Are Who We Are, a show very much centered on gender identity, sexuality, and your character playing an army soldier who goes to Italy. I mean, there's so much going on in the show that I've never seen before. Your character, Sarah, I've never seen that character. Again, playing a lesbian. And her in this environment, in this very macho environment, but that Luca has created where it's actually this very welcoming environment. I thought that was, you know, we're so used to these tropes of, you know, the hateful male energy and having this woman come in. I really enjoy that about the story. Tell me what attracted you to this particular character as she relates to other characters you've played.
I was interested in her parenting style.
Oh yeah, that was questionable at times.
And just the responsibility that she feels to her son, and also being selfish about her own work and kind of putting that in front of her son, and just kind of like,
and seeing her wife sort of bristle at her selfishness and
living in that and seeing, because, you know, I think that that's kind of going to be something I'm going to have to think about, you know, in the future.
And also the fact that you were expecting at that time, and then playing this character with a unique parenting style, I'm sure you had a lot to think about in your own
life. I mean, mostly I just wanted to work with Luca and do whatever he has. But I mean, the perks were that this woman was really, you know, intelligent, complicated, and had this, you know, complicated relationship going on with her wife and her son, and Jack, who's an amazing actor playing her son.
He is really great.
Yeah, he's so full of life.
And it also made me think there's probably so many women like her around the world serving, whether they're able to be open about who they are or they're not, but just such an appreciation for the way that character was drawn. And she was just a soldier. That was her job. And there was no sentimentality attached to it. It was very matter of fact. And I thought what he did was just...
I think that she ultimately had political aspirations. So she was used. Yes. Yeah. I think if there were to be another season, which it doesn't feel like now, but that was kind of... It was that those things were going to be revealed.
Right. I'm very intrigued to see what she would do next personally. And then now we come to the two shows that we got to enjoy this year, Russian Doll season 2. Obviously you'd worked on season 1. Your part was a little bit smaller, but tell me about, and Natasha has obviously spoken a lot about this, you know, the post season 1 break and obviously delays in creating season 2, when the two of you obviously are so close, mapping out the vision that she had and her creators had for the show, what most excited you about, I mean, just the meta universe of playing her mom and how that relates to your off-screen relationship, which I know you guys are so close.
Right. Well, season 2, I play her mom, but I'm also like playing her in quite a bit of it.
Yes.
And I was very excited by that, scared of doing that, and it ended up being far more challenging than I had anticipated.
In what capacity?
I just am not good at like mimicry. I've never been good at like impersonations, and I was like,
"Oh, interesting.
So well, it's going to be so easy. I got this." And then I got on set, and I was like, "Wow, this is really hard." And I think I would be on set, and I would watch her do the scene on the monitor, and I mean, she just inhabits that character so well. And you'd be like, okay, now you go do her. And I'm like, what? No.
Right. You're not, I'm not a comedian.
Exactly. I'm like, give me the drama.
Well, it really, I mean, even just watching her host SNL, you really...
That was in the audience. Yeah, but there are certain scenes where we're together, where we're looking at the slideshow, and then another.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
We're in the mental institution, and
that scene was great.
Kind of riff with her and allow like our friendship to come through, and really special experience.
Is it hard to be so close with someone? Then maybe if there's a note to be given, is there a reticence on her part to say, actually,
Chloe, no, I remember she was having trouble with that scene, and I was like trying to direct her a little bit.
Well, that's good. You look like you're having a blast. So I'm so happy you were able to execute that.
How can I do it again? I was like, you did it. We have it. It's like, you know, so there was like a trust that I think helped both of us.
Yeah. You can't beat that friendship factor, right? And then, of course, The Girl from Plainville, a very different piece, terribly sad. The true story of the death of Conrad Roy in 2014 after he was egged on to take his own life by his girlfriend. And you played his mother. Firstly, I can't imagine doing this role after you had become a mother yourself. And did you have access to any of the real people associated with this case? Did you meet his parents or anyone else who knew the family?
Well, I met with Jesse Baron, whose article the show is based on, and he had a lot of time there, months on end. But I did not speak to Lynn. I thought that it might get in the way of being able to take creative license because it is a story, and so often
I hear that from actors so often where they say they actually prefer not to have
because we are, you know. Yeah, it is a television show. We are, you know, constructing some things. And so, I think I would have felt even more pressure, if I had spoken to her.
And did you have any strong opinions about this case going into the show? Because I had read about it, but I did not know half of the events that had preceded this terrible event.
No, me neither. The first thing I did was watch the HBO documentary and then, read and watched more. And but I knew very little. I remember seeing photos of Michelle and assuming she was guilty just because of the way she looked. And
isn't that funny what we perceive and then we learn more about? I mean, again, that we don't excuse behaviors, but at least we start to understand why at least some of them were exhibited on her part, at least. I mean, just a terribly sad story. What attracts you to wanting to tell a story like this that is so hard and so sad and probably really hard to leave behind at the end of the day? I mean, this we're already in a really hard time in the span of humanity. Why take on something that is so incredibly dark? What is the purpose that you see as an artist?
I think, like you said, I think a lot of people are grieving and going through grief and trying to figure out how to navigate that. And I find comfort in watching films and television shows where I can relate to people, to their problems and feel less alone in what I'm going through. And I was hoping this could serve as that. I also think people are really challenged with today's means of communication and immediacy and,
mental. Well, children especially are clearly struggling.
Mental health and how we recognize that in others, who do we reach out to? So I thought there was a lot to talk about and bring forward. I know that Elle Fanning has a huge young audience. I thought, if one young person watches this and then has a friend and that friend says something and this was that triggers them to then call their parents or the principal, it's worth it for me.
Absolutely. If you could just help one person.
Yeah.
And did you hear any feedback about the way you portrayed this very grieving mom that really made you feel good about making the decision to play this part?
I mean, I've gotten a lot of great feedback. People, think that I helped, ground the show and, just how emotional it is. And, people that have gone through loss and grief and really feel it in my performance. And, I hope I bring them some sort of comfort. Yeah.
I think what you do bring to this is it's never overdone. It does always feel real because grieving doesn't look the way we think it does, right? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily someone wailing, at a funeral. It's very internal and it can hit you later. It just never goes away.
Yeah.
And I think you have a real subtlety with that work. That's really fantastic. And then coming up next for you, it sounds like you're doing something else with Luca. Can you reveal anything about that project?
It stars Timothy Chalamet.
Well, that's a good first step.
A cannibal love story on the road.
Okay.
They run into different characters along the way.
Okay. I felt like it was inevitable that Luca was going to have to work with Timothy at some point.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, this is like,
I saw the movie last week. It's so beautiful. I was like, I just wanted to live in the world forever. Yeah, I can't wait to see it again. I think
his work is so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And of course, you are also a director. You've made three short films, if I'm not correct or not mistaken. I'm surprised to not see you directing in TV. Is that something that you'd like to start doing?
I've talked about doing some TV stuff. I was involved with pitching a few things and talked about doing some more commercial work. But I think that I want to start off with a movie.
Okay.
I've decided hearkening back to my early years of small
riot girl years,
setting the tone with the future, I think, is kind of where my mind is.
I love that. Mm-hmm. And it was, so I was watching some clips of other TV work that you had done, comedy work. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, you're very funny too. I think we need to see this side of you. You were very funny on Will and Grace, Edie Falco playing your girlfriend. And if you can hang with those guys on that show, that's pretty amazing.
Wow. That was so surprising. Wow. This is how, I was such a huge fan of the show too. I was like, this is how this works. This is crazy.
I went to a taping of Will and Grace once, and we were there for 5 hours in the audience as they fine-tuned every word, every joke. It was the most incredible. I felt like I was in a theater workshop.
Yeah, they're a very talented group.
Very talented.
Now I can never watch the show again. It can happen like Portlandia and Louis, like all these shows I was huge fans of. Like after I did them, I was like, now I can't watch the show anymore.
Because it's like ruined for you that you were on it.
Somehow, all the magic.
Oh, that's not true. Well, I'd love if you have any, you know, a lot of these conversations are centered on advice and inspiring the next generation of artists. Is there something that you would love your fellow guild members to know, whether they be actors, writers, directors, just anything about the business now, which in some ways is struggling immensely, but there's always a way to tell a story and to show your work. So what would you tell someone who is just kind of like struggling to get a story out, struggling to get a project made? What would you tell them?
Oh gosh. I don't know. I think if you have a story that you love and you really want to tell, you should, you know, just persevere and, you know, make as many contacts as you can, you know, and respect everybody, no matter what position they're working in on any project that you're on. Come to work knowing your lines and being on time, and respect everybody around you. And you never know when you're going to want to call on them again, or, you know, if they can help you in some way. You know, in my short films, I've used countless people that I worked with in the past, from ADs to DPs to special effects to producers to actors, you know. So it is such a great opportunity to meet people and make connections. And I think it's really important just to, you know, take the time to really talk to everybody in every department. And, you know, don't isolate, and, you know,
and also get to know the process. Get to learn what every department does. That's what I always hear, is don't think that just because you're an actor, you don't know what the DP is doing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And don't be too much of a snob, right?
Yes to everything. Anything.
Well, whatever you have done has worked beautifully for you. So we're so proud of you, but also thank you for these two incredible pieces that you've done this year, Russian Doll and The Girl from Plainville. And I know people are going to continue to explore them. And as this pandemic continues, we still need joyful, moving storytelling. So thank you for doing your part.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time to talk to me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation, and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.